I mean, what is the American dream to you today? Because there's a real underside to this.
Yes, because there's a dispute about what that dream is or how it would play out in different circumstances. And of course, you know, everybody in the United States and probably beyond, but most especially those of us who have to live under the Trump regime, are constantly being shocked day after day after day. Trump has effectively destroyed nearly every one of them. Fortunately, at a certain level, the courts are holding up. And fortunately, the people are standing up finally. And I think that's been one sign of great hope. But for the MAGA base, and it's diminishing, fortunately, the American dream is essentially been narrowed into a white Christian nationalist notion of things, so that everything that falls outside what they imagine that to be is not only undesirable, but should be the subject of extermination, deportation, detention, massive investigations, you know, former directors of the CIA, FBI, anybody who is perceived to disagree with Trump is put under immediate investigation because those things have to be eradicated. On the other side, what we see, and this is something that comes out in the interview I did with Ellen Schrecker, who's a long-standing American historian of McCarthyism, is that unlike McCarthyism, Ellen points out, this time around, people are standing up. And it's been incredibly heartening to me to see. There was a recent story about suburban grandmothers in Chicago standing up to ICE, deportation. So I think it's tapping into the best and the worst of us. And I think that I'm heartened by the fact that more and more of the better angels, I think, are coming out with a more capacious and expansive notion of what the American dream could be.
Our guest today is an activist scholar who believes the classroom is inseparable from the public sphere. David Palumbo Liu is the Louise Hewlett Nixon Professor of Comparative Literature at Stanford University and a founding faculty member of Stanford's program in Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity. But his work has long reached beyond the academy through his book, Speaking Out of Place, Getting Our Political Voices Back, and his podcast of the same name. He insists that the great global crises of our time, from escalating wars and democratic failures to environmental collapse, are fundamentally crises of value and voice. His recent work has put him on the front lines of campus activism, challenging institutions, resigning his membership from the MLA, a move that highlights the ethical cost of speaking truth to power. We'll talk about what he calls the carceral logic of the modern university and why art and poetry are crucial tools for survival in times of war, and what he tells his students about preparing for a future defined by uncertainty. His perspective is rooted in literature, but his urgency is all about the world we live in now. We'll discuss the forces that silence dissent, the imperial logic of AI, and what it means to be a moral active citizen when the systems we rely on are failing. David Palumbo Liu, welcome back to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Mia, and thank you for such a generous and very comprehensive introduction. So I very much look forward to our conversation.
So just to get a bit of background, because you've been on our show a few times, and of course, we are also proud to share the stories of Speaking Out of Place on the Creative Process. But to orientate those who don't know, tell us a little bit about your background growing up in California. What brought you from your Chinese studies, the comparative literature studies, to what was like the catalyst when your path shifted from being a scholar of literature to being a scholar in the public political arena?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story in that I began my graduate career writing on 12th century Chinese poetry. And this is something that was very important to me as a Chinese American. I always wanted to know something about the culture that I was born into. And the best way to do that was through literature for me. And so I began to study poetry, not from the modern period, but from the ancient period, because I understood there's a continuity in art forms, and art forms are also cultural forms, and cultural forms are embedded in societies. So that was important to me. And as I was working my way through graduate school, and I use the word work purposefully because we got a certain number of fellowships, but in graduate school at Berkeley, you were also expected to teach. And so at that point, the Asian American movement was just beginning, and the Berkeley campus was one of the main locations for that development. And a professor who had a very similar trajectory in that He was Asian American, but he began his graduate work in ancient Sumerian at the University of Chicago. Then he came to the Bay Area and became very politicized. His name is Ling Chi Wong. And he reached out to me and he said, you know, would you like to TA for me? I'm developing this discipline. And I said, well, I don't know anything about it. And he said, well, that's what's interesting about it. So one half of my life, I was studying philology and ancient Chinese language and literature. And then on the other half of my life, I was an activist, essentially, because Ling Chi had us go into the community. One of his interesting innovations was at that time, Berkeley had an American cultures and institutions requirement. So every undergraduate had to take a course in American institutions. And Ling Chi said, let's talk about how institutions work in the real world. And so he had us go into the communities like Asian American organizations, mental health, for example, clinics, law clinics, and say, well, how does the American dream translate into the locations in which minorities live? And what's the disparity between the two? And how can we make those institutions actually work at the local level in minority communities? And this became kind of a model for things that happened in the future. And it was not just in terms of ethnic minorities, became things like queer communities, women, et cetera, et cetera. How do these large ideals translate or not translate into local practices? So that's how I became somebody who was involved in both things at once.
Now, you mentioned something very important that we're all really questioning. I mean, of course, going to communities and that everyone has a different interpretation and experience of the American dream. And I guess as your activism has continued, I mean, what is the American dream to you today? Because there's a real underside to this.
Yes, because there's a dispute about what that dream is or how it would play out in different circumstances. And of course, you know, everybody in the United States and probably beyond, but most especially those of us who have to live under the Trump regime, are constantly being shocked day after day after day as, you know, talking about, as I did a moment ago, American institutions. Trump has effectively destroyed nearly every one of them. Fortunately, at a certain level, the courts are holding up. And fortunately, the people are standing up finally. And I think that's been one sign of great hope. But for the MAGA base, and it's diminishing, fortunately, the American dream is essentially been narrowed into a white Christian nationalist notion of things so that everything that falls outside what they imagine that to be is not only undesirable, but should be the subject of extermination, deportation, detention, massive investigations, you know, former directors of the CIA, FBI, anybody who is perceived to disagree with Trump is put under immediate investigation because those things have to be eradicated. On the other side, what we see, and this is something that comes out in the interview I did with Ellen Schrecker, who's a longstanding American historian of McCarthyism, is that unlike McCarthyism, Ellen points out, this time around, people are standing up. And it's been incredibly heartening to me to see, there was a recent story about suburban grandmothers in Chicago standing up to ICE, deportation. So I think it's tapping into the best and the worst of us. And I think that I'm heartened by the fact that more and more of the better angels, I think, are coming out with a more capacious and expansive notion of what the American dream could be. In my work, as you know, Mia, I've tried to denationalize things. So what I think is best for America is best for the world in some ways, which is to break down these barriers of hatred and prejudice to let us be more connected to the world in general.
Yes, and we should note that we're recording this today on Thanksgiving.
Yes.
A very problematic imperial, you know, talk about the story of occupation.
Yes.
I mean, what are your reflections on that as well? On this day of thanks, I mean, what are you thankful for as much as, you know, honoring that very problematic history?
I try to, as crises come out, and again, as you and I were talking before the actual taping, I'm getting older. So I'm becoming more reflexive about religion and spirituality. And I always remember being brought up as a Christian. My father was a Christian and not an excessive Christian, but he felt that we should give thanks, you know, for everything that we have. And so that part of me is coming back to life. I am thankful for the world. I'm thankful for nature. I'm thankful for people's generosity to each other. I just resist and, in fact, reject the nationalist framing of this, especially since, as you point out, Thanksgiving is supposed to centers around this completely aberrant notion that the indigenous people and the colonizers sat down and had this wonderful feast. And maybe that happened one day, but the next day, the settler colonial project went on full steam. And we see the results of that. It's not as if that peaceful moment was sustained into our national history. No, it was exactly the opposite. So I've never been a fan of Thanksgiving in that framing. I'd rather appropriate it my own way just to give thanks in a more planetary way.
Yeah, attuning to the music of nature, with the earth and the seasons. You know, as long as we look after the earth, that it will look after us. I did want to go a little bit more into your reflections on spirituality and religion, because so much of, as you say, the indigenous and environmental movement have those tones about, you know, at least gratitude, appreciation. And I know that in your own creative process, you also make music, you make paintings as perhaps a way of finding clarity, how you find time for this and what it gives you.
Well, I think what it does most for me, and I underscore that I do neither one of those professionally, it's mostly for just a sense of bringing things into the world that sound and look nice to me. It happened that I started playing the guitar, for example, when I was 13 years old. And then, as many of us do during graduate school, we put those things aside because they seem to be frivolous and not meaningful. We have to really bear down on getting our PhDs and whatnot. But with the first Trump era and with COVID, we all found ourselves isolated. And I remember, and I'm sure you do too, seeing different YouTube or TikTok or Instagram postings about, well, now I'm learning how to bake bread, and now I'm doing yoga, and now I'm doing this. And I think that isolation, as devastating as it was, also, at least for me, made me think, what can I do for myself? In other words, with the onslaught of the virus and with the onslaught of Trump, what can I do that's protected from that, you know, in my own isolated space? And so I began to play the guitar again, and my wife was very generous in that she allowed me to buy a lot of guitars. She felt that that was a good therapy. And so that to me was a sense of things like that. And a lot of people did think of different kinds of self-care exercises, physical, mental, spiritual. It puts you back in touch with your capacity as a human being. I think that was really grounding for me, to be able to sense that I could do this, and no matter what happened with COVID or with Trump, this is something I could do to change my mind, to change my body. And I would take those things with me always. And even now today, it stood me in good stead to come back to those practices in this new set of crises.
Yeah, having a good meditative practice. I mean, obviously, there's long been the links between music and activism. And of course, which you cover a lot, poetry and activism. I mean, finding that clarity where we can come together around something emotional and personal, which is also political, because not everyone who are most affected by the issues that you discuss on your podcast come from academia, you know, or they don't even have, when you're talking about Gaza, they don't even have, well, their university, everything, all their infrastructure is obliterated. But connecting around the arts is a really important way to deliver those messages quickly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is something, and again, connects people in ways they can't express in any other form. And even silences, if you know, when you play music and you're a dancer, you think of those times when you're not moving, but the gesture is towards something, right? And the ability to have that interval to fill in what is not said or unable to be said makes us a participant, even when somebody else is the one who's producing the music or choreographing the dance. It gives that interval is so important. And I've talked a lot about with Jameco Osorio, who is a Hawaiian poet, a lot about that moment of suspension. And I recently did one with Nicholas Mirzoff and Priscilla Wathington about To See in the Dark. And that's Nick's beautiful book. I haven't uploaded it yet. But all these notions of intervals, of darkness, of things that are not, that stall the usual rational progress of life that we have to go on to just to be practical human beings, that gives us a sense of touching base on something that's been hidden from us that lets us emerge ourselves, that space or that light.
Indeed, and you've also covered a number of, you talk about the carceral state, both in America and elsewhere, the writers who had to smuggle their writings out of prison, which I don't even know how a manuscript survives in that state, you know, how it becomes such an act of courage to just get it out there into the world. All these stories have been, you know, really moving and important and not covered enough by the mainstream media, the individual lives.
Yeah, the mainstream media has its commercial interests. It has a public that it feels it has to serve by giving certain kinds of information. But this gets us back to at the AI area of our agenda, so to speak, today, in that the mainstream news is a commercial interest. And so it develops audiences and audiences' interests around a very narrow spectrum of things. It's not to say that what's in that spectrum is necessarily unimportant, but when we narrow our vision so enormously, we excise and we erase all sorts of stories that are part of the larger picture. And so this has huge intellectual, spiritual, political consequences when we have such a powerful media, which is why the creative process and which is why alternate media is so important. And even things like TikTok or Instagram, while not perfect, are other venues where people are able to upload images of the world that circulate and other people find resonant in their own lives.
Yeah, and indeed, I mean, we've seen, I mean, it's double-edged because AI, well, through social media for the last 20 years, we've had what's happened to us under social media, which of course, you know, AI is in that as well. So we've seen how it's harmed our politics, democracy, journalism, the public and personal discourse. But, you know, it can be little havens of community, of course. There are good things. And you mentioned during COVID lockdown, these were ways that people could reach each other and not feel so isolated and also get some important, you know, maybe health news out or also misinformation. Yeah. But now I just want to go to the last 20 years and what it has done to us and what now with AI, how that's going to bring everything up a notch. I mean, what are your concerns for the next 20 years? I know you recently had Karen Howe on and discussing the empire of AI and all these things, but, you know, and how can we really take an active role in slowing this runaway train?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people that share our concerns. And in fact, I haven't uploaded this episode yet, but her name is Erin McElroy. And she wrote, I think it was called Silicon Valley Imperialism. I think that's the title of the book. And she has a really interesting background in that she's part Romanian, but a lot of her work is in the Bay Area. And she started as, and she continues to be a housing rights activist. And then she went to Romania and visited friends there who are in the housing rights realm. And she visited a town named Cluj. And at that point, Romania was portraying Cluj as the Silicon Valley of Eastern Europe. And so it was a really interesting book that ties together housing rights with technology, et cetera, post-socialism. But that's the general background to the specific point I'm making, which is that Erin discovered there were all these ways in which people that were trained under socialism developed notions of being together that were not part of the dictatorship, but quite part of an almost classical sense of socialism, that gained technological skills that they were then revitalizing today to fight the kind of AI takeover. And they were developing ways in which there were community servers, there was slow technology, they were repurposing old iPhones, et cetera. And Erin told me there's going to be on May 1st, which and the date was chosen purposefully, in some place in the Pacific Northwest, an international conference on alternatives to AI and alternatives to computing in that vein. And so that's going to be a very interesting moment that will highlight just how global the resistance to AI is. And not only that, and you mentioned Mamdani, that, you know, there were two gubernatorial races that same day. And both those candidates who were liberal, moderate liberal, semi-progressive, both women, spoke out against these data centers in Virginia, in particular in New Jersey, which are eating up huge amounts of resources and wreaking all sorts of violence upon communities there. So I think more and more ordinary people, even outside the applications of AI, are becoming concerned about the environmental consequences of taking up so much water, taking up so much energy to the exclusion of other uses of those same materials. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful there is resistance. There is a kind of distaste. And the whole promise of the tech bros is also being put under new scrutiny because so many of them are affixed to Trump. I'm sure you watched that Nobel acceptance speech of the person who was a champion of AI, but he said, there are no guardrails. That's the problem. I mean, there's great promise, but with governments backing away from regulation because they want to let the capitalist train go full speed, it can lead to horrible results and devastation that we can't imagine. The necessity, and it goes back to the first part of our conversation, of democratic institutions for people to have a decisive voice in managing this technology. All technology is not necessarily bad, but, and this is something that Karen Howe brings out in our interview and in her book, it's the power differential that's frightening. It's not the technology, it's the power differential.
Yes, as she outlines, which I think is such an interesting point, that they justify it because they feel these, we're talking about largely American or Western AI companies, but they feel there's an evil empire and we're the good empire.
Exactly.
And so we have to control it. Europe is doing their best, but implementation is another thing. But I do want to go back to talking about there are people out there who are inspiring our better angels. And you mentioned Sohan Mamdani's victory, and you've recently had Eliza Featherstone and Doug Henwood came on to talk about the elections. It's been so inspirational. Victories like Mamdani's are something I'd like to see spread across more of America. I'd like to see that movement really take root. I mean, how he came from like 1% to he just grew exponentially. The idea that everyone belongs here and how he was able to bring in all the issues, said that he would lose on, you know, the housing is important. That's how housing, everyone can relate to that. But also immigration and LGBTQ rights. Mm-hmm. And he made a space, and of course, for human rights in Gaza. These could all fit together, and there is a space for it when you appeal to people's common sense.
Yes, and you know, he really tapped into the young population. I mean, he's a young person himself, for goodness sake, the second youngest, or maybe the youngest person ever elected mayor of New York City. But if you look at his campaign team, they're all in their 30s. And I think the combination of generations working for common values that have been buried and obliterated since the 1980s under neoliberalism is really a sign of hope. And the fact that most young people are speaking out about Gaza, speaking about climate change, because this is the world they're going to inherit, and they understand that this may be the last moment to intervene. And the most hopeful thing I've had happen to me recently is that because of this tremendous burgeoning of ICE, which now has a budget that is almost as great as the U.S. military or someplace approaching that, in East Palo Alto, so Palo Alto is a very affluent town, but there's also East Palo Alto, which is on the other side of Highway 101, which is largely Hispanic, largely poor, and targeted by, there's a big Home Depot, and this is where ICE people would come to pick up people who are there as day laborers. And there's a new organization that's new in the sense that it began no later than 8 months ago. And I started to volunteer for it. And we basically just sort of walk around and get about information about know your rights, et cetera. And for example, escort school children as well. And it was all started by this young woman, Anglo-American elementary school teacher. She's probably about 33, 35. Just one person who began, and now we have like close to 60 or 70 volunteers that go out starting at 6 o'clock in the morning, taking hour patrols. And I was on patrol the other day, and a young girl was running. She looked like she was sort of skipping along, but running down the road. And the founder of the organization said, I always have to check up on whenever I see a child running these days. In the old days, it was a sign of joy, but always have to double check under these new circumstances. As she watched the girl, and then the girl ran to her mother, so everything was fine. She breathed a sigh of relief. And then the mother looked at this woman and just waved because she knew her. I mean, it's developing these kinds. I mean, they don't know each other well, but just the fact that the people in that community see people from outside the community coming and caring about it is another sign of hope and solidarity that's informal. Who knows how long it will last, but it taps into something that I think we can nurture, and I hope we can nurture and expand.
wonderful what you're doing and that grassroots commitment. And it is sad when you hear these stories, the lost innocence. I heard stories that, you know, children who talking about housing insecurity in their neighborhood, and they've had to move and pass through gentrification. So the sign of a tree being planted is not one of growth.
Yeah.
And it's like, we may lose our home again, we lose our family, you know, lose our
exactly.
friends, our schools. So a sign of a child running should be with hope and joy, and not to think about the negatives. But I do think about, of course, what you've covered, the children of Gaza who are born with the faces of old men,
yeah.
you know, because yeah. they're so malnourished,
yes.
if they, to survive to that
yes.
point, even.
Yeah. No, it's horrible. I mean, the children are the hope. And then when we deprive them of the means to, I mean, this gets back to just ordinary human rights, you know, the idea that every human life is worth supporting, as in the Jewish tradition, every life is a world. And we're destroying whole worlds because we don't know what any individual life will bring into our world. It may be the next great musician or the great scientist who will find a cure for diseases that will improve thousands, millions of people's lives. We don't know what we're excluding and killing when we either destroy it or, as I said earlier with regard to media, narrow it down to such a tiny spectrum of possibility. And again, this is where art is so important. It gives us a sense that you could bring something into the world that's not commercialized, that's not massified, commodified, but it's just a sign of human imagination and possibility.
Yes, and you've brought others on your show, of course, the Jewish Voices for Peace, and they set such a good example. I guess that's another added level of courage when, you know, they have to speak out against their family lines and, you know, their
yeah.
normal allegiances.
Yeah, absolutely. I admire their courage so much. Fortunately, there are more and more who are doing that, but when you risk alienating even your immediate family, I mean, I've seen families split down the middle because of very different kinds of commitments and, you know, getting back to different narratives. I mean, when you place one narrative against another and decide this one makes more sense to you, it excludes a whole other set of possibilities. So that's why, again, being able to live in another person's world for just a moment is so important.
Yeah, and I always wonder, when you're an activist, how do you measure the success when it's been such a long haul? To bring,
yeah.
Now we have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others that I never thought would have this kind of take on the situation have. It is very complicated, but at least it's gaining that kind of momentum. How are you measuring the successes in this last few years?
That's such a, I ask that question nearly every episode. And when I had Nick Mirzelf on again, he quoted John Berger's notion of undefeated despair. And then Robin Kelly has the line, success without victory. And there are many different variations of it, which is that small successes that don't necessarily amount to a total victory, but just day by day, leaving possibilities open. Small victories like having somebody wave to you in a neighborhood that would not usually recognize you. All those things leave possibilities open. And I think it's important, Berger's expression is so meaningful because we have to acknowledge our despair. It would be foolish for us to tough it out, imagine that, well, it doesn't count. Of course it counts, but it's a despair that then feeds into an even more profound commitment, I think, precisely because you recognize it. And that's where the undefeated part comes in, right? You recommit, so it's not defeated, it's still alive, but it's cognizant of the enormity of the task. And again, something else we've talked about today a lot is the sense of breaking the isolation, and even if it's momentary, but it shows up in all sorts of almost banal ways. When I'm on my walk in the preserve, and I've taken now to being more systematic about saying hello to people, you know, just seeing the smile on their faces and they reciprocate, even that sign of recognition is important, because otherwise we're hunched over our phones or in our darkness, feeling like there's nothing we can do. But again, I think in the United States, I've never seen such a mass movement. Closest thing to it was the anti-war movement. This galvanizes people, and this is where Marjorie Taylor Greene comes back. It has people from both sides of the aisle, so to speak. Now, as you say, she's a politician, so you never know what calculation she's making. But what lies behind it, regardless of what her actual motive is a recognition that the old two-party system isn't working. And actually, I don't know if you've watched, she's gotten to be quite popular, she's an historian, Heather Cox Richardson. I don't agree with her all the time, but I think she has exactly the right sensibilities. And she's constantly comparing this to the mid-19th century when you had, again, the robber barons, and you had this notion that only the most entitled elites were capable of running a country because everybody else was dumb or stupid or whatever. And she said, somebody asked her, do you think we should have a third party? And she said, I think no, that in the United States, the two-party system is there to stay. However, parties can change. And I think this gets back to Mamdani. I think the Democrats, and maybe even the Republicans at some later stage, are recognizing that people care about basic things. They don't care about, you know, pronouns. They care about having food on the table. They care about health care. And this cuts across whether you agree with somebody in terms of issues of identity, issues of sexuality and whatnot. I think everybody deserves, and this gets back to basic human rights, a right to an education, a right to health care, a right to retirement, and a right to have a voice in the way the state runs and have reasonable disagreements. I think that's fine. But when we're so polarized, which I've never seen anything like this in my life, for such a sustained time, to the point that our president tears down half the White House and people say, well, that's fine. It's just, I think people finally reached a point of saying, no, it's not fine. And in this, I don't want to call it a renaissance because it should not be a renaissance. It should be a revolution in the sense of bringing something new into the world. I think this is going to be a very interesting next 4 years. It's going to get worse before it gets better, which is why we need to be undefeated in our despair.
Yeah, revolution indeed. And the revolution will not be televised. I think it has to come to the streets.
Yeah.
And so there, you mentioned the robber barons. And on that point of influence and persuasion, we've seen for several months now, a lot of commentators are now highlighting just how deeply embedded and involved AIPAC is in American politics, which I think a lot of us knew. But the fact that it's really become a huge talking point when normally it's behind the scenes activities or a no-go area, I mean, that's something that I've appreciated in recent months.
Yeah, the fact that now at least a few Democratic candidates or politicians are refusing to take AIPAC money because they understand the stigma attached to it now, whereas before it was taken as a norm or even a badge of honor. But it's the convergence of AIPAC with Christian nationalism. I mean, there's so much of a merger between the two because you have white Christian nationalists now signing on to the Zionist narrative of the apocalypse, the final judgment. And so that's what's so frightening. And that's what drove so much of the political perspectives up until very recently. But now that's breaking down, again, because more and more people are coming up and saying that the amount of money that we give unquestioningly to a state that is fully committed to a genocide and the fact that there's no hiding from it anymore. I mean, every single international body has come out with data. The Gaza Tribunal, you know about, has come out with an archive that is indisputable, that all the statistics that we hear now are just the tip of the iceberg, and the environmental devastation. It'll be decades before the rubble is cleared and before the agriculture comes back, if at all. And then, you know, we have Trump's vision. Well, we don't need agriculture. It'll all become, you know, luxury apartments. It's just people, I think, are finally understanding that there's a connection between that kind of devastation and what's going on in the Amazon and other places. So it's those series of connections that I think education and art is so important in nurturing, and that people are now, again, young people are recognizing because they have such a stake in it.
I was interested to listen to one of your recent guests, Yoon Song Kim, and detailed how the Frick Collection and these other elite institutions, they've had these collections founded upon erasing labor of these union-busting robber barons, which I hadn't really reflected on that. When you talk about beauty and the importance of the art, it's a, you know, it's a beautiful collection, the Frick. I interviewed their director, and I thought, oh, it was a place of solace for me, but to think, of course, it's built on this kind of violence of property.
What she brings out is very interesting because I use part of that to talk about immigrants, sort of jumping the track, so to speak. This goes back to the episode I did with Pooja Bhatia, who was in Springfield, Ohio, when the whole notion of they're eating the pets and things like that. Dehumanization works when you take away the human contributions that people make. You erase the fact that we are so dependent on migrant labor. There's no question about it. When you substitute the narrative, they're all criminals, they're stealing things, rather than the opposite, which is that they're giving us things, that is really devastating. And the robber barons were actually robbers. And Woody Guthrie, the famous American folk singer, has the line, some men rob you with a pistol, some with a fountain pen. And this is what happened during the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, right? When you had bankers going in and robbing the farmers by having them take out huge loans to get the kinds of tractors and combines they would need to be competitive at that time. So I think that, and of course, here I am at Stanford University with one of the great robber barons, Leland Stanford, who famously hired a number of ex-Civil War soldiers to hunt Indians. This is, and Malcolm Harris in his book on Palo Alto lays this out very forcefully. So we are in another Gilded Age. There's no doubt about it when you have the Peter Thiels and Sam Altmans deciding that democracy is an interesting but dispensable artifact, but what's needed now is brilliant people like themselves to determine what is good for the rest of the planet, not just other people, but the entire planet. That's a level of robber baronness beyond imagination. And people are finally, again, getting very disgusted with it when they see the degradation of life for most people, the cost that we're bearing for this robbery at that level.
Yeah, and it's talking about that just, you know, dominating this planet. And yes. It's like they're talking about putting data centers in outer space, like as though it wasn't bad enough that we have them all here, I guess, out of sight, out of mind. But I think that that's prone to breakdown. I don't think that that's well thought out. But yeah, this kind of, they're like, you get a sense that they're kind of feel like they're in a science fiction fantasy, you know, and they're just playing out their little games on this, you know, where all these little pieces, those pawns at their disposal.
No, absolutely. That's really what's the most frightening to me is when, in that moment in the podcast with Karen Howe, she says, essentially, they just want a blank check, you know, they just want us to give them all the power and money in the world because they will do something that's important. And Karen points out, they've never told, I mean, yes, they'll solve climate change, this and that, but we can solve climate change perfectly well by ourselves by not burning all this fossil fuel to begin with. But no, they seem to have this notion that there's a secret formula that only they have the intimations of, although they can't name it, but trust them. And of course, people are now beginning to see the cost of me trusting you is my livelihood. This has really reached a tipping point, I believe, which again, I feel is going to come, but it will be worse before it's better.
Yeah, I do think they also project into the future. They have, because they believe that, some of them believe that they can live forever. They think that they can upload themselves to the cloud so that when their view of this perfect world they can create is far beyond our lifetime. So this world can get destroyed, but they have this whole sense. But in the future, they'll be appreciated because if you take a really long view, all their dreams will come true. I don't really understand that philosophy.
Well,
but
being an older person, I can say this, that who would want to, I mean, it's one thing to want to live forever, you know, and when I leave this mortal coil, I do hope that there's some sort of spiritual extension of me. But who would want to have their lives forever? I wouldn't want to have their lives now for a millisecond because it's filled with anxiety, competition, greed. They always have to have more. It's almost a drug to them, power and money. And I wouldn't want to live like that even for a millisecond, but much less an eternity, because they would be worried that their eternity was going to expire at some point, so they would have to conquer more. It's really a pathology that we should, all other people should take as a warning signal. You know, this is not the way to spend life. The way to spend life is to breathe deeply and to appreciate a flower or anything that is there for you to appreciate for free. You know, and life is finite. I firmly believe.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty when you see that we either, according to your belief, pass on to another dimension or we get subsumed again by the earth. But that fleetingness is what brings the beauty. I want to talk a little bit about your experiences in the university. You had an episode there with Robin Maynard on policing Black lives, abolition on a transnational scale. And we're touching on the models of liberation and challenging the nation state. And I'm just wondering, how do you apply this prison logic and what you see? How does it show up like in a major university today? Like, is it student debt, the surveillance, or how the protests have been handled?
Yeah, I mean, all the things that you mentioned, and I keep on reminding my students of this constantly when they're very, very depressed and feeling isolated and overwhelmed. I always say, well, remember you're at Stanford University, because I do believe it is the epicenter of many of the worst things that you just mentioned. We certainly, in terms of the encampments, the violence perpetrated on the Stanford campus was minuscule compared to what happened at UCLA or NYU or Columbia or at CUNY. So we do have that to be grateful for. It's a longer story about why that was the case. But in other instances, the sense of being brutalized is incredible here, because we're constantly having people like Sam Altman float through. I mean, the physical location of Stanford is inescapable. And the only way that we find ourselves able to withstand it is to work in small groups, to work outside the classroom, to work in communities. It's like literally a breath of fresh air, because otherwise it is quite stifling. The anxiety, especially in this economy, to find a job when there are fewer and fewer jobs. I mean, even in computer science and engineering, there are fewer jobs, not only because the market is saturated or outsourced to other countries or taken over by AI. You know? So people are at a loss, and all they're doing is, many of them are just doubling down, saying, well, it won't be me. I'm brilliant enough to make it. And of course, to do that, you're putting more stress on yourself. And so I find many, many students just absolutely depressed, stressed out, anxious. And because of the courses I teach, I have a very particular constituency. And so I often say to my classes, this is a class where you're not going to be evaluated in the ways you are out there. It's not going to be your usually organized tight ship that you expect with everything hitting marks. It's going to be an invention of the class that we invent here. So if you'd like to be in the experiment, you're welcome to. I will teach you, but we will teach each other as well. So that's that, and the podcast are my two lifelines. But I think that what I found at the Stanford campus is, yes, there was repression. We had 11 students charged with felonies now for occupying the president's office. The district attorney chose to indict them through a grand jury, not through a public jury. So grand jury proceedings are secret. Now they're going to trial. He's charging them with felonies. And Stanford has determined the amount of money these 11 students, many of them first-generation students, who are there to protest the genocide and Stanford's lack of response, even though we've gone through all the normal channels. They're demanding the students repay Stanford, one of the wealthiest universities in the world, $300,000. They will not tell us how they arrived at that figure, but even the judge has offered three of the students the ability to plea down and charge at a lesser level, not as felons, but as people who have done misdemeanors, which is a much lesser charge. And the district attorney was horrified the fact that the judge would intercede and offer them something that he hadn't. But remember that if they plead guilty to a misdemeanor, they're still pleading guilty. They will still have a criminal record, and they will still be liable for that $300,000. So it's really pernicious and horrible. And the students have mobilized around this energetically. They're packing the courtrooms. Even with the repression, and I've interviewed students not just at Stanford, of course, but CUNY and San Jose State, every student group that I know in terms of Students for Justice in Palestine and other associated groups are coming up with different ways to avoid the most severe punishments. For example, at Stanford, they decided, okay, you can have marches, but no more than 200 people at a time. And so what students are doing is, we'll have 50 people on this side of campus, 50 people there, and others silent protests and other ways, because the main point is to keep Palestine out in front of the public eye, always, to never let go of that. So we find institutions like Harvard and Stanford and Columbia and Penn capitulating to Trump in the most horrible ways possible, you know, giving up certain ways of expressing ourselves, even while telling us that academic freedom is intact. It's not. So it's really a generational battle, which, again, is something important. It's a fight. The best thing that many of us feel we can do is offer an alternative. It's not we're going to convert people, but we're going to put forward a set of other possibilities of how to look at the world. And I think a lot of students appreciate that. Not that they're going to be converted, but just because they will take a class or two as a slight counterbalance to all the other kinds of pressures that they're facing. I'm not without hope, but I feel that there's only so much that I can do. What I do is important, and again, just offering an alternative. And this gets back to one of the first questions you asked about my training in graduate school. And when I became a professor, I had, and this is way back, you know, 35 years ago, for God's sake, so way before, you know, a lot of what's going on now, but students would come up to me and said, because I'm an Asian American male professor in humanities, which is, we're like unicorns, very few of us, saying, I just never thought you could say something like that. And it's so important just for you to be here. So even at that level, I think one should not dismiss that. And so I encourage people to show up at places, not to be there for the rest of their lives, but just to appear on the streets, as we were saying, or carry a sign, or talk to a neighbor. Well, if you haven't elected so-and-so, then you don't count. No, I think the world changes incrementally and at different scales, and different people will have different kinds of impact, but having some impact is better than having none.
Yeah. And what's so upsetting with some of these crackdowns on the protests is, just because you're anti-Zionist does not mean you're anti-Semitic. They're completely different things. I mean, I just don't even understand that conflation. It doesn't even make sense. It's just a question of recognizing humanity, as you say.
Absolutely.
No, you have, we talked about you resigning from the MLA in protest because you want to stand up for against the support for Israel. But some people find, as you said, they're not at a position where they can say that. So what do you recommend to people when the most effective action that citizens or activists can take?
Well, I was on the Executive Council, which is an elected body of the Modern Language Association, which is the largest professional organization of literary scholars in the United States, I think, maybe 17,000 members. It's huge. And it's a great organization. It does a lot of really good work. But in 2014, 15, 17, around that time, we brought forward, not the Executive Council, but members of the MLA, myself included, as an ordinary member, not as an Executive Council member, brought forward a resolution to support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And it was defeated there were various improprieties in the process in which certain voices and operations or functions were shut down. And so I resigned at that point, saying, I've had it with the MLA. You know, we fought the good fight, but the opposition was able to do sort of subversive procedures that some of us called out and that were ignored. So I just left. And then a couple of years ago, another group said, no, we have to mount a similar campaign. And I said, okay, I joined the organization again just so I could vote, but I wasn't really part of that whole planning and organizing because I had done that, but I was supportive of it. And the difference between what happened the first time and what happened recently was that this time, the Executive Council wouldn't even let the discussion be had. In other words, before we had a debate, we went through and had the ordinary hearings, et cetera, put before the general membership. But this time, under a much worse situation in Palestine with the genocide, the Executive Council just stifled even the discussion. And that's when I left. So that's the MLA. And the person who recently won the highest prizes in the MLA, the Scaglione Prize, resigned, and his statement is beautiful and repeats exactly some of the points I just made. So what can people do who are not in a position to resign or resist. I think the most important thing is to talk, even privately. And everybody has different levels of precarity. I'm an elder tenured professor, so I'm one of the most protected. At an institution, I must say, who has never censored me. Stanford has never even, there's never been a faint hint that I shouldn't teach a class or have a podcast or do anything. So I must recognize that with gratitude. But again, it gets back to the basic notion of bringing something into the world. When you're with, you know, a coworker or somebody that you're in an exercise group with or whatever, and I've heard this story from other people, so I'm not making it out of thin air. And somebody said, well, you know, but Hamas did was horrible. And so Israel's response is legitimate. And he said, well, actually, Israel is attacking people who are not part of Hamas, and they're killing children. And do you think that's okay? Just asking that question, having somebody, and now the person who made that initial pronouncement may not change their minds, but it may insinuate into their way of thinking, well, maybe I should think about that. But when somebody else has the same question to them 2 weeks later, 2 months later, that will be part of their memory. So again, it seems so insignificant, but people have changed minds. I mean, under the course of the occupation, people have come to a very different point of view. And if you look at the global standing of Israel now, it is completely different than it was in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s even. Diametrically different. And it's because of not just historical events, but getting back to literature and the arts, different interpretations of what those events signify. So I would say to anybody, anything from a conversation to making a donation, donations are anonymous, joining a protest march, again, anonymously, all those things are really important because it's better than nothing. And I think you'll feel better about yourself and that you stepped up to the best of your ability. And you'll find that your life situations might change such that your ability might expand in some ways. All those things are important.
Yeah, and the sad thing is the loss of lives, really, the long-term generational trauma that is yet to be fully understood, what that does to these generations of, you know, when people learn that we can't fight hate with hate, killing people never solves anything. You think that the world would kind of know this by now? Social media has made it unavoidable for all of us to see the worst of humanity on both sides. And I hope it's just waking us all up.
And exactly. I've had the chance to speak, get to know some of your students. So I know the effect and your inspiration in the world, and you've had some really interesting programs.
And so, David, can we talk about education as it is now, as opposed to, say, as it was in the time and the teachings of June Jordan and Audre Lorde? I don't want to be nostalgic for it, but it's really, there's a lot of issues we have now with silos of knowledge, the past ideals and values, like the humanities and the arts being ignored, and the confusion, as you were talking about earlier, with students not being able to foresee a future. And I speak to a lot of them too. They just don't know where they're going to find jobs that they've studied for. The jobs that they've studied for are becoming largely obsolete in many cases. And now, you know, so many students, they say 90%, but more like 100% of students are using AI. We're in this massive upgrade moment that we can all feel. New pressures, expectations on work, relationships, how we communicate with ourselves and with others. What do you think is needed to move towards remodeling our imperfect educational institutions to meet the needs of today and try to catch up with the fast pace of change?
Well, that's a great question, because I had Jesse Hagopian on, who did his book Teach Truth. And just the other day, maybe a couple of weeks ago, actually, I was at our local grocery store, and on the counter there was this a bunch of magazines, and I found this.
Don't Stop Teaching About Gaza, Rethinking Schools.
Yeah, so Rethinking Schools is this new magazine that's now finding its way into even suburban grocery stores. I'm not sure how much wider it is, but Jesse is one of the people who started this, so I'm having him back on And it's not always going to be about Gaza. It'll be about the ecology or whatever in every episode. So I love this idea of bringing, I mean, because you usually see like GQ or, you know, Glamour magazine, or, but now having this out being sold widely and bringing education to people just gaining their groceries is really, I think, very interesting and inspiring. And so I asked Jesse and his co-editor to be on the show, and they're going to be on, and I'll send that to you. So what inspires me is two things. One is, and nurtures me, is when students come in with questions. I always begin the class with what we call here check-ins, like how are you doing, what's up? And they will come up with, not all the time, but often questions that show that their minds are working in ways that they're feeling that in this classroom is a space where they can articulate that and that it's a proper use of time. And that's the other thing about schools is, you know, time is precious and you have X number of minutes in the period. So those two things to me helped me a lot in thinking that, for example, when Trump wanted to ban books, there was a huge protest. I mean, people don't like not having libraries. And I think maybe it was New York Public Library began to offer free digital copies of banned books and things like that. So just the fact that, again, as much as people don't like high food prices or don't like not being able to see a doctor or get vaccinated, they like to read. They'd like to have the freedom to read whatever they want to read. And so I think this is important. It's people not being complacent with what they're told and rather demanding things. And that can take place with people protesting book bans or else students coming into classroom saying, I want to learn, I want to talk about this. The other thing I do in my classroom is to say, if there's something that you've learned either in another class or just by yourself that you think is relevant to what we're talking about in terms of what does an undocumented mean, please bring it up. And so people come in with not just facts, historical facts, but they say, I read a really interesting poem. Can I read it, you know, to the class? I think it has everything to do with it. Say, absolutely. So that's the other thing that I think I'm encouraged by is when students neglect the boundedness of the classroom, either temporally or physically, and just bring in things from outside. Because that's the way the mind works. It should be always synthesizing prior learning, current learning, and future aspirations. So those things help me, I think. This is something that's so American in that when I go to Europe, I mean, people are, you know, I'm riding on the metro and people are reading Heidegger or, you know, whatever. But America has this long and entrenched anti-intellectual strain. It's really hard for other people outside of the U.S. to understand how practical America is, so to speak. And that pragmatism has a good side to it, but it also has a deadening side to it. So the arts and literature and speculation are considered to be fine, but proportionately only fine, like 15% of your time can be used that way. So it's really, I think, important and significant to me as somebody born and raised in America to see these capacities being regenerated. It wasn't always this way. There was always this strain, but it's never been so all-encompassing as it has been in the last decade, I would say. And now, so it's nice to see the tradition is coming back or still vital in some ways.
Because you've given quite a few critiques of capitalism. I mean, what do you think the origins for this hyper-pragmatism is in the United States?
Well, right now it's because all those things that we used to rely on have been taken. And so we're thrown back on ourselves. I mean, even the Yellow Vest movement, you know, the protests about the readjusting of the retirement age. When I looked at the protests, I forget what age it was, but in the United States, our retirement age is far higher than that. So I think it's the lack of support by institutions, by social groups. I just think that all these things are happening at once. We had COVID, we have Trump, we have environmental devastation, we have Gaza and all that Gaza represents in terms of a world order completely, an international world order and international humanitarian law, international law period completely failing, right? So all these things, if you think about it, now you've got me on another train of thought, but if you think of the birth of the United Nations, now the United Nations is not a perfect organization by any stretch of the imagination, but it's better than, way better than nothing. It came in place after the Second World War and with the invention of nuclear weaponry and the sense that we had better have a stable world order because things are very precarious. And so you had conventions, you had protocols, you had the United Nations, and all those things are completely shredded now. And Gaza shows us how weak those things are. It's been completely taken over. So I think in general, especially in the United States, there's a sense of isolation and fear, and hence this huge lashing out at immigrants, just to have another group to blame for this, when actually the blame is with voracious capitalism that's far outstripped. I mean, let's imagine that we'll always live in a world of capitalism, but not at this extreme. I mean, this is where the robber baron thing comes back. The wealth disparity is greater than any other time in human history. It's just people having trillions of dollars and feeling that's not enough, and the people not being able to buy groceries. How can the two sit side by side? So I think that's the world we live in. And so people are, it's almost the survival of the fittest. And once you swallow that, you lose sight of solidarity, right? You think that anything you need has to come at the cost to somebody else. And again, I think that young people are realizing that's a deadly game, and people are now forming groups of solidarity because they realize that that's really, and Dean Spade talks about this a lot. I'm really grateful for the younger generation and very protective and supportive of them because they have the courage that we'll need to survive.
Yeah. You've given them great courage and tools of critical thinking and your undefeated despair. Mm. I guess just in closing, as you think about the future, the importance of the arts, the importance of leading a critical life of introspection, and doing the most with this life that we're given, and remaining steadfast in solidarity, that phrase I liked from one of your recent episodes, that phrase, samud. What would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
It's very interesting. I'm going to borrow from somebody I recently interviewed. Her name is Nilo Tabreze, and she works for the Washington Post. She works in the visual forensics area. And her book, she co-authored a book about the Iran rebellion, Women, Life, Freedom. As somebody in visual forensics, she has to, and she writes about it in the book, in order to substantiate a story, she had to look through thousands of photos of tortured bodies. And I said, how do you do this? And she said, and this will be on the podcast, so I'm not divulging anything she didn't divulge to me for the public. She said, I have a really good therapist who said, you need to turn off, you just have dedicated time to do something else because you cannot, I know you're passionately committed to getting the truth out, but you need to take care of yourself. So self-care is so important. And again, self-care should not be something like 15 minutes a day of doing something, you know, minimal. The world, I mean, one thing that I say to myself all the time is the world can get along without you. That's, you know, I can make that. That's not the same as saying that I don't make a contribution, which you so graciously articulated a moment ago. But the world will be fine. I mean, in terms of nature, not human world, but the natural world is amazingly resilient. And the human world has other people to carry on. So we are all interdependent. And as long as you're doing what you can when you're engaged, that means that you not only deserve, but you need the arts, you need music, you need to be quiet and be silent. So all those things are for your good and for everybody's good that you contribute to. It's not a luxury, it's not cowardice, it's not you backing away, it's you. I mean, I'll tell you a story that I've told on the podcast before, and this goes back to the first Trump administration. And when he had the Muslim ban, there were spontaneous demonstrations at major airports, right? I remember going to the San Francisco International Airport, and there were just masses of people. And I ran into my dean there, which I was very surprised and gratified to see. I had another commitment, and people, I just noticed, again, it's nothing I said, I just noticed people were leaving. But as they left, again, just organically, new people would come in. And I think that serves as a metaphor and a symbol of what I'm trying to get at. Is everybody has other parts of their lives. Nobody's a full-time activist. And everybody needs time off. But as long as we share a spirit of common values and common interests, then there'll always be somebody else. So that's something else to remember.
I think that's so true. If we're embracing the same mission and goals are fairly aligned, we can act in one mind. That doesn't mean our mind has to be on constantly.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're not machines. That's really important to
Thank
know.
God.
Not AI.
Yet.
Yes. Though some might wish to turn us into them. So thank you, David Palumbo-Liu, for modeling for us how wherever we are, we can speak out of place, get our political voices back, and use the power of community and connection for the public good. By sharing nuanced conversations, you show us that there are many forms of compassionate, nonviolent, knowledge-based resistance, and we can actively engage to create a better tomorrow. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I must add, it wouldn't be possible without you, Mia, that my podcast is so dependent on your knowledge and your support and your coaching that I have so much to be grateful to you for. So thank you.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.